Welcome to the Learning Forums podcast, sponsored by Distress and Crisis Ontario. Learning Forums offers programs specifically designed for DCO member organizations. This podcast is meant to inform, educate, and support your work. Enjoy the program, and we welcome your comments and feedback at learningforums.ca/contact with the subject podcast.
My name is Annalise Trudell, and I'm coming from the Coalition Assisting Trafficked Individuals. We serve London and Middlesex County. So I wanted to start today off with a story to give you a sense of who is human trafficking. Marussia McRae. For me, it started just by hanging out at the mall with my friends. I was 14 and a half. I came from a middle-class home and had good parents who loved me. But then along came these older guys at the mall. They were so smooth, and they told me I was beautiful. They would find out the tiny little things in my life I wasn't happy about, and they'd magnify them. One day, I was invited to a party. I was raped, beaten, and dropped off in the morning. They made me think I was the one that wanted it all. I felt I couldn't go back to my parents. I was ashamed. I was taken to another man's house, and I was raped again. And then I was sold. I was then taken to an apartment, and other girls were there. We had to take off our clothes and were stood in a line. A guy, he must have been in his late 40s, had sex with each of us, picked the ones he wanted to buy. We were moved to another apartment that night, all the girls sleeping in one room, and we were put in two cars and taken to Calgary. They asked me why I didn't run away. They don't give you time to think. You're 14, you don't know what you're supposed to do, and you're scared. And then suddenly you're in a different city and you don't know who you could run to. That's one of the many stories we have of a human trafficking survivor. They look different, but one thing I wanted to call our attention to is that is a Canadian, that is someone from our country. That's not the Hollywood stereotype of an international girl being brought over, right? So part of the presentation today is to really focus on what it looks like here and to debunk some of those stereotypes. The purpose is not to train you in enforcing human trafficking criminal codes, of which there are three, nor is it for you to be an expert to definitively know what trafficking is and looks like. But it's to get that icky sense going in you when you're on the call with a caller that, oh, there might be elements of trafficking going on here today. So we're going to cover four different modules. We'll define human trafficking. We'll look at what it looks like in Ontario. We'll get a sense of how to recognize someone going through human trafficking and then how to support someone going through human trafficking. So to start off, let's start defining human trafficking. Well, the generally utilized definition comes from the UN Palermo Protocol, and it has an equation-based formula. So you're going to take one element of mobilization, one element of means, and one element of purpose, and add them up. So under mobilization, you can see that you could transport somebody. For the means, you would use coercion, and for the purpose, you would have forced labor. That would be an instance of human trafficking. But from the list in front of you, you can tell that there are a variety of different equations that can result in human trafficking. So there's no one concise definition of what this has to constitute. So let's keep fleshing this out. Another way of thinking about human trafficking is to juxtapose international versus domestic trafficking. So international has to cross an international border, and that's usually what Hollywood will focus on, right? Either from Asia or Eastern Europe, bringing over a young woman forcibly, usually in chains, to work in the sex trade. But we know in Canada that 93% of trafficking occurring here is domestic trafficking. It isn't sort of the international girl being brought over. And the other debunked myth I'd like to sort of focus on is this focus solely on sexual exploitation. The other form of human trafficking that occurs is forced labor. And that can occur in a variety of settings. Here you can think of nannies, you can think of construction workers, nail salon workers. There are such a variety of locales that trafficking can occur in beyond the sex trade itself. And I did want to sort of create a bit of a gray zone for us in the use of statistics. Human trafficking was only really sort of brought to the forefront in 2005 when the criminal codes were passed. So we don't have a clear statistical grasp on what's happening. In addition, we also really know that labor trafficking is underrepresented in the statistics we do have. Because labor trafficking, say you're a migrant farm worker out on a farm in Leamington, your exposure and interaction with social service and law enforcement is very, very minimal in comparison to a sex worker who's forcibly working in the sex trade in London, Ontario, who has more potential interaction points. So our ability to statistically understand both of those experiences is skewed. So just to be wary of when we look at stats on human trafficking in the region. Another way to start defining human trafficking is to compare it to human smuggling. So human smuggling always involves crossing an international border. As mentioned, human trafficking doesn't have to involve that. Human smuggling is voluntary in the sense that the person has paid a smuggler to bring them from point A to point B. Human trafficking is not voluntary. Now, I want to add a caveat to that. The human trafficking relationship will often start as one of seduction. So it's with somebody they know and they're brought in through seduction into that relationship. And so in that phase, there might be elements that seem choice driven. But at the end of the day, human trafficking by definition is a form of labor that's not fully choice driven. So it's not voluntary in that sense. Human smuggling ends as soon as that smuggler brings the person over the international border. That relationship ceases. Human trafficking, going back to those original sort of equation definition, the mobilization moment is the very beginning of that relationship. So they transport them from, say, one end of the city to the other, or from London into Windsor, and then they start the relationship of exploitation once they've moved them. So that helps us start to categorize some differences. I'd also like to draw the attention to where they work. And I've mentioned a few of the locales, but let's expand on that. Migrant farms, factories, restaurants, nail salons, beauty spas, construction sites, houses, and then the sex trade. So brothels, massage parlors, strip bars, hidden apartments, basements. There's no end to the locales that human trafficking can occur in, but one thing they often have in common is their precarious forms of labor. They're under-regulated, under-monitored, and that's sort of where the trafficker can find their way in to utilize people's labor. Now, the trafficker. This is an important sort of definitional understanding of trafficking because it's a relationship. So we tend, through Hollywood and the media, to think of the trafficker as this lording over, dominating physical figure, right? Who uses physical force to force somebody to do something. The way that this usually plays out is actually, it kind of forms a triangle. So think about the first layer as seduction. They create a relationship with you. They're either already in a relationship, they're your boyfriend, they're your mother, your parent, or they sort of give you gifts and bring you into that seductive relationship. Once they've established those routes, they'll bring in coercion, so they know enough about you to start forcing you to do things by threatening, and then maybe eventually into violence. But if you're on the call with a caller and they're telling you some story or some trauma that they're experiencing currently, they're not going to say, my trafficker this, my trafficker that. They won't identify that person as a trafficker. They probably won't identify their own experience as human trafficking. They might love the person that is trafficking them. They might defend them to you on the call. So we need to start really better understanding what that relationship looks like and that it's a little bit different than our myths indicate. Now, we have a bit of a sense of what human trafficking is in terms of definition. I'd like to start to flesh it out as a profile in the sense of what it looks like in Ontario. Now, the numbers game, it's a challenge. I've mentioned we don't really have statistics on this. And there's been a lot of media and attention drawn to the issue of late, but we're catching up with the numbers. Why don't we have numbers? It's a hidden clandestine crime. It happens underground. And the exposure and contact points with law enforcement and social services are pretty minimal. The other point to take note of is that people experiencing human trafficking rarely identify their experience through the language of human trafficking. So they won't say, hi, I need help, I'm going through human trafficking. They'll present to you on the call some trauma that they're experiencing, and their most immediate need. So why are they reaching out for help right now? I need shelter, I'm in danger, right? They won't qualify it as trafficking. So we haven't been checkboxing our little statistical inputs, right? We haven't been able to gather that data. qualitatively, we do have a sense of who we're addressing, and that's where I'd like to focus. And this information comes from law enforcement as well as social services in the region here. So the majority of cases encountered by law enforcement concern sexual exploitation. Now, does that mean that we have more sexual exploitation than we have forced labor going on? No, because law enforcement may not be encountering forced labor. But those are the cases that they're mostly dealing with. There is a vast overrepresentation of Aboriginal women and girls in our region. We know this. We don't have the statistics behind that, but we know this. And we can think about why that is. The vulnerabilities that Aboriginal women and girls face that would sort of allow for that seductive relationship to be established by the trafficker and to bring them in. And think about what a trafficker can offer someone. A sense of belonging, a relationship, love, and all the material things that might be in need, right? So shelter, housing, food, clothing. When you have need, that's something for them to grab onto and pull in on. The face of trafficking is young. So the average age of entry and recruitment into the sex trade is 13 to 14. That's young. That doesn't mean that the average age currently is 13 to 14, but that's when they enter into that. That's a vulnerability, definitely. It's domestic, as mentioned, 93%. Now, if it is international, the suspect will usually share the same ethnicity as the person being trafficked. So they'll speak the same language. And if they're calling to you and say you're having some interpretation challenges, you might not want to ask that person to reach out to the person beside them to help translate, because that could be their trafficker, right? It could be their boyfriend who is their trafficker in that moment. So we have a sense of what the definition of trafficking is. We have a bit of a profile of what that might look like in our region. So let's move on to, okay, how do we start to recognize this when we're on the call itself? Everybody loves indicator lists. Everybody wants those check boxes to work through so that we definitively know this is trafficking. I'm not going to give you that. What I'd like your takeaway today to be is that icky sense. So you start to have a spectrum of understanding of what trafficking can look like. And when it doesn't feel choice-driven, and when you have sort of an icky sense about a certain relationship in that caller's life, that's enough for me. That's enough for me to sort of have you say, this might be trafficking, so here are the supports I'm going to provide. That being said, I will give you some indicators that are useful in this regional context. So one is not being able to move or leave their current job. Being unaware of local surroundings. That's big because we know that roughly every 2 weeks or so, the trafficker will move their labor. So in this region, there's a corridor from Windsor up through London, Toronto, Thunder Bay, and back. And if they're trafficking in sexual exploitation, the pimp will move them along that corridor. Why? They can't establish any grounding and roots. They can't reach out to social services. And so they're really kept very, very isolated, right? So when they're on the call with you, they might not mention family and friends. When they talk about their daily life, that might not involve a lot of exposure to anybody except for their working sort of environment. They might show evidence of control, intimidation, fear. If they're involved in the large criminal networks of trafficking, they might have some tattoos, which are a form of branding, particularly on the back of their neck, which on a call you might not be able to see, but if they mention tattoos. They won't be allowed to hang out with friends or family, and particularly that should ring a bell if they're youth. If you have a 17 calling you who doesn't talk about any friends or school life, that's not normal. Why are they so isolated in that moment? I'd also like us to think through the mindset of somebody who's experiencing trafficking. So we have some indicators, but what are they thinking when they're on the call with you? Well, they're unlikely to identify as victims of human trafficking, and I've mentioned this, but I'd like to nail it home. That's not going to best describe their experience to them. Why are they calling you at a crisis line? They want to talk through their trauma, and they want to reach out for a very specific need or support, right? So that's their most immediate need. Their backstory might be one of trafficking, and that might come out in counseling in multiple exposure moments with social services. But with you on that crisis moment, that's unlikely to be how that story presents itself to you. They're also quite likely to distrust outsiders. So think about this. They're isolated into a subculture. They're allowed very limited exposure to anyone outside of that subculture. And there are values instilled in them in that subculture. One is to distrust police and any outside support. So even them making a call to a crisis line is a huge step. If you prompt the idea maybe of reaching out to the police because there are significant safety concerns, they might react quite strongly against that. And to just understand where that's coming from for them. They might feel better in their current situation than whatever alternative you provide to them. Again, think of that triangle with the trafficker. If they're in that seductive phase, they're going to be defensive of their trafficker. They might like this life because it's all they know in terms of that subculture. They might be unaware of their rights, and they might be fearful for their family or friends. So oftentimes, the trafficker ends up using coercion and threats against family members or friends to keep the person being trafficked in line. So that fear might very much so present itself on the call with you. So now we've defined human trafficking, we've given it a face, we've offered some indicators and prompts for on the call, but now what do you do when you're on the call with someone who might be experiencing trafficking and you're getting that icky sense that this is the storyline that's occurring? Your role again is to not identify definitively that it is trafficking. If you have a sense that there's something not choice-driven going on and that there's something a bit sort of uneasy with you with the relationship in a certain part of their life, that's enough. So then we move to assessing safety. And I'm sure you've all gone through safety planning training, but on the call, are you safe to talk to me right now? Can I help you get to a place where you are safe? Make sure that they're feeling secure in that moment. Then there are some prompting questions on the screen, and they help to sort of flesh out some indicators of trafficking. And these come from survivors. So they, for them, were really defining moments of their trafficking experience. So what happens if you refuse to work or not do some part of your work? Are you scared your boss will tell your family or friends about what you're doing? Where have you been staying? Oftentimes, they will be forced to stay in the trafficker's home and won't have any options in terms of living arrangements. If you want to buy a cup of coffee, do you have the money to do that, or does someone hold your money? Do you have to have a fix just to do your job? Is the person you're working for willing to give you alcohol and drugs? This is not an exhaustive list, but there's some helpful prompting questions that you can use on a call. And finally, make referrals. So if they're presenting a specific need to you on this call, shelter, safety issues, counseling, that's like all the other callers that you have, right? You have a need in front of you. You are the experts at making the referrals. That's the training you've gone through. The one thing I'd like to additionally add to that is that if your caller is calling from out of region or is about to be moving to another region, there are a variety of coalitions across the province in different areas and cities that represent trafficking. And if you know that your caller's moving to Sarnia, you might want to give them that number because they are the experts in the Sarnia region at navigating the supports that someone experiencing trafficking might need there. So just as a reference point. Now finally, you'll see an image on the screen right now. And this represents the journey through the system. So you'll see that there's an intake moment, and that's what you always do on every call. You get a sense of what's going on, you assess for safety, and then you address, okay, is this a primary need? Do they need shelter? Do they need security, medical assistance? Or is this a secondary need? Do they need access to counseling, cultural services, transitional housing? And you do this intuitively as crisis line workers. This is what you've been trained into. And what I'd like to point out is that human trafficking is no different. If you have a human trafficking call that you have a sense that there might be elements of that going on for your caller, there isn't a whole new set of protocols to follow. You use that same journey that you do with every other caller. You assess why they're calling you today. You help them in the next step forward in their journey in that moment, and you help navigate the system for them. Finally, here's another image on the screen of what the journey probably looks like to them. It's not linear. There's no entry point, there's no exit point. It doesn't make sense. And whether that caller is a human trafficking caller or another kind of caller, I'd just like to remind us that this is how overwhelming that system looks like to them. And you are the ones that are the connectors. You are the ones there to help them navigate through that. So your takeaways today. Giving that icky sense when you're on a call, that, okay, there's something not choice-driven but the form of labor, there's some kind of control going on, that a certain relationship in their life, it doesn't feel at ease. And once you have that icky sense, to follow the normal route that you do with any other caller in crisis, making sure they're safe, prompting appropriate referrals, and helping them on the next step. Does anybody have any questions?
So these callers are obviously in a vulnerable place. Is there something that we shouldn't say, anything that could frighten them away?
I think the only thing that I would be aware of is to really push the option of contacting the police, because again, they often distrust law enforcement. And something that we know, so in domestic violence cases, it will often take up to 8 interaction points with social service before someone takes sort of that step for action. We suspect that it's the same for human trafficking. So on the call with you, that might be call number 3 for them. And just reaching out is the huge step there and sort of gaining trust that you're a safe space. So to not push law enforcement in that moment, but to recognize that it might take another 3 calls prior to them really wanting to take that action moment. Any other questions or comments? Well, thank you very much today. If you'd like more information, please go to www.katielondon.ca. We've got lots of background information on what is human trafficking and different coalitions across the province as well. Thanks.